Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect workshop, Understanding the Molecular Portrait of Breast Cancer. This is such an important topic, and you're going to hear lots about this in the next hour. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on this call 786 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from many different regions and parts of the country. And we also have international participants from Australia, Bolivia, Canada, Israel, Korea, South Africa, Uganda, Venezuela, and New Zealand. So you really come from all over the world, and you really are a group of information seekers really wanting to find out as much as you can about breast cancer and its particular features. Now, today's program was made possible by an educational grant from Caris Life Sciences, and I really want to thank them for supporting this program today. This is a topic that we actually really would like to be able to offer more often. It's an important one for everyone to understand all the details. Now, you received from Cancer Care information, and in that informational materials, you received information about our speakers, the collaborating organizations as resources for you. And there also was an evaluation form in there, and we ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs and workshops that we should be offering going forward? Indeed, we're entering a new year, 2013, right around the corner, and your suggestions could not be more timely for us to consider. So we really appreciate your feedback and your thoughts. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Generosa Grana. Dr. Grana is professor at the Cooper Cancer Institute. She's head division of hematology oncology, Cooper University Hospital, and she's associate professor of medicine, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University. And Dr. Grana is going to present an overview of breast cancer, including standard of care. She's going to talk about the role of personalized medicine. She's also going to discuss innovations in biomarker testing and molecular profiling of breast cancer, and a bit about communicating with your physician, your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Grana.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'd like to begin just by highlighting the fact that the treatment of breast cancer has improved dramatically over the last 20 years that some of us have been in the field. The surgical management has improved, our radiation therapy approaches have improved, and systemic therapy, the medical oncologist world, has definitely improved. And much of that improvement has come from a better understanding of breast cancer. We're going to talk today about the molecular portrait, but really that whole field has evolved and has helped us to improve the outcome for women. For many years, the selection of treatment for a particular patient was based on features that were identified grossly in the pathology report: tumor size, lymph nodes, if affected, and how many were affected. And later we evolved to look at specific markers, the earliest predictive markers, estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, some people like Ki-67 as a marker of proliferation, and the HER2/neu receptor. Research, however, has now shown us that breast cancer is even a more complex disease than that. We can no longer just focus on ER/PR and HER2/neu. Research has suggested that genetic features or genetic profiles can identify up to maybe five or more subtypes of breast cancer that behave differently, have a higher risk of recurrence, may recur at different points in time, and may need specific targeted therapies. Even within one of those specific subtypes of breast cancer, the triple-negative breast cancer population, even there may even more subtypes, six or so different subtypes within that specific group that may be able to be targeted by specific drugs. So as we're getting more and more refined, we're learning that we can better pinpoint the prognosis of a specific cancer, and we are getting better at potentially selecting appropriate drugs for that particular patient. In metastatic disease, there are also new technologies, some that help us identify if we have some uncertainty about where a particular cancer originated, some technology that helps us identify the primary site of origin of a cancer, or other technology that can help us select therapy. So Keras, for example, looking at a benefit of a particular drug targeting a particular pathway. We are beginning to look at testing that can help us predict where a tumor might metastasize to, what cancers have a predilection for brain versus lung versus bone or other. So again, this research looking at the specific molecular profiles of cancers is going to be very rich and is going to really help us in the future. Not only is this research going to change our use of drugs and the specific selection, but it may also have an impact on how we manage the breast locally. This type of research may help us look at who is more prone for local recurrence. I'm going to talk about that when I talk about oncotype, and who may or may not benefit from radiation or who may or may not need radiation when we're talking about subsets of cancer. Much of the research that is ongoing is still just that. It's in the research arena. But there is a rapid evolution of this, so I think we will see much coming out in the next few years that will change our practice. Where are we today with personalized care for breast cancer? That's what I'm going to walk you through in the next 5 minutes or so and really begin to focus on early stage breast cancer and then bring up several other issues. So, as I mentioned, the easiest way to think of breast cancer or the subgroups that we clinically can manage very easily are broken down into the estrogen receptor positive population, the HER2 positive population, and that other large subgroup, which is the triple negative breast cancer population. Focusing on the estrogen receptor positive population, we do have actually several genetic profiling tools that can help us to select management for the woman with early stage breast cancer. Most of you are aware of tools such as Oncotype or MammaPrint, and these are measures of genetic alterations in a cancer that can be derived from the tissue material that's obtained at the time of lumpectomy or mastectomy that can then give us a better understanding both of prognosis, who is at high risk of recurrence versus low risk of recurrence, and can also help us delineate the benefits of treatment. Are there subsets that require chemotherapy and benefit from chemotherapy versus others that may be better served by just hormonal therapy? In addition, can this technology help us to identify those patients that are at increased risk of local recurrence? There's some data from Mamonas and others that suggest that maybe the Oncotype score can help us predict who's at higher risk of local recurrence. And there was just some data presented this past year looking at DCIS, non-invasive cancer, to help us determine where radiation therapy may or may not have a role. Typically, those two tests, Oncotype and MammaPrint, are used in the lymph node negative population, and we use them again to determine who may be able to forego chemotherapy and would be better served with hormonal therapy alone. But there may be a role for this same technology in the node positive population and again in DCIS. I think many people feel that that's still a bit preliminary, although some clinicians are using it in those populations. We're awaiting results from two important studies. TAILOR-X was a study done in lymph node negative patients that were in that intermediate risk group, looking again to see whether that population benefited from chemotherapy or whether hormone therapy alone was sufficient. That study's been closed, and we're waiting for results, and that will really change the standard of care depending on the results of that study. A study is ongoing now looking at patients who have 1 to 3 positive lymph nodes. Again, what is the impact of Oncotype and what is the impact of chemotherapy in that population? So in the future, I think we will be using these tools much more broadly to help define treatment for women. In today's world, if a woman is hormone positive and based on Oncotype, we determine that she needs only hormonal therapy, what are her options? In a woman who's premenopausal, tamoxifen is her option. There have been several studies and are awaiting results of others looking at whether ovarian suppression will add to the benefit of tamoxifen or whether ovarian suppression plus an aromatase inhibitor will be better. But today, for premenopausal women, the standard of care is tamoxifen. This year at San Antonio, data was presented suggesting that 10 years of tamoxifen in that population was superior to 5, with some slight increase in uterine cancer risk, but overall a significant advantage for that population. So this is a new dialogue that we're going to have with these women that are premenopausal on tamoxifen. For the woman who's postmenopausal, we have the option of tamoxifen, an aromatase inhibitor, sequencing from one to the other, and the questions that still remain to be asked are questions about the benefit of sequencing, the duration of therapy. One study is looking at the question of 10 years of aromatase inhibitor therapy. So what I tell my patients today is that it's an evolving field. We need to stay tuned because some of this data will be coming out in the short future. For the patients where, based on their oncotype or based on other features, chemotherapy plus hormone therapy is the selected approach, the key there is that there are a variety of agents that can be used, and it's important that we have a dialogue and that that dialogue include the patient and the physician in terms of selecting the right chemotherapy. For the woman who's HER2-new positive, clearly chemotherapy plus Herceptin has become the standard of care, and this is a choice even in very small tumors, 5 millimeters or thereabouts, and these women are recommended chemotherapy plus Herceptin. There was recent data presented suggesting that 2 years of Herceptin was not better than 1, which is reassuring because that is a long course of therapy. I think the question that still needs to be answered is potentially shorter duration, less than 1 year, but as of today, the standard of care is still 1 year of Herceptin therapy. For the triple-negative breast cancer population, chemotherapy is the mainstay of their therapy, and again, we're treating women with chemotherapy who have very small disease, 5-6 millimeters of disease, and chemotherapy should be considered. Many questions remain for that population on appropriate drug selection, whether platinum compounds play a role in that population, whether PARP inhibitors will improve the outcome in that population. So this is an area where a tremendous amount of research is going on at this time. So again, in terms of personalization, I think the key is that there are various choices of chemotherapy regimens, and the choice of chemotherapy regimens is not written in stone. There is a lot of flexibility. It needs to encompass the woman's medical history, whether she has a cardiac history or not. So one needs to decide whether to add or avoid an anthracycline such as adriamycin or epirubicin, whether one should use a combination such as CMF, cytoxin methotrexate 5-FU. If a taxane is to be used, should one use docetaxel or not? In the woman who's getting Herceptin, several regimens have been published in combination with Herceptin. How do we select amongst those? Again, I would argue that it needs to take into account the medical history of the patient. And at the end of the day, all of this needs to encompass a lot of communication between the patient and the team, an understanding of the toxicities, an understanding of the priorities for the woman. If it's a very young woman and she's interested in fertility preservation, that may play a role. So communication is really a very important topic. And I'll stop here.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Dr. Grana. That was really an excellent presentation, and really you covered a lot for people to take in terms of, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, but you've made some of the complex very understandable, so thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Grallo. Dr. Grallo is professor at medical oncology at the University of Washington School of Medicine, Jill Bennett professorship in breast cancer. She's Director, Breast Medical Oncology, Seattle Cancer Care Alliance. Dr. Grallo is going to address new treatment approaches, targeted therapies, and the role of clinical trials in advancing what we know about breast cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Grallo.
Thanks, Carolyn. And it's my job to reinforce, after Dr. Grana's very excellent introduction, how we're using what we're calling the molecular portrait of breast cancer to really get more cures, less deaths from breast cancer. We are really making some advances by a better understanding of what's unique about each cancer. So moving right along into let's start with estrogen receptor positive disease. Dr. Grana has given us a little introduction about what's new with respect to some updates at the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. Well, we have a problem that we can't really reliably pick out which tumors are going to be very sensitive to anti-estrogen therapy and which are going to be resistant. We know that even when we select for estrogen receptor as the indication for using estrogen receptor targeted therapy, that some of those tumors respond very nicely and some don't. So estrogen receptor all by itself isn't the only thing that predicts for benefit from anti-estrogen therapies, such as tamoxifen, the aromatase inhibitors, and fulvestrant or Faslodex that Dr. Grana mentioned. So some strategies and trials looking at overcoming resistance to endocrine or hormonal therapy have been conducted, and we've actually just had the approval of a new drug in a new class. The class for overcoming endocrine resistance we're calling mTOR inhibitors, and the drug that was FDA approved just within the last year to help add to anti-estrogen therapy in tumors that are growing despite the anti-estrogen therapy is a drug called everolimus or Afinitor. This is a drug that had been approved for kidney cancer. And we knew, based on laboratory studies, that we could see some benefit in tumors that were getting an aromatase inhibitor, and then you added this drug in the class of mTOR inhibitors, we would get response all over again. So the drug was tested in a trial of tumors that were progressing despite being on an aromatase inhibitor. The patients were switched to another aromatase inhibitor, were randomized to get the mTOR inhibitor, Afinitor or not, and they showed both a benefit in terms of how the tumors responded and how the patients did in terms of how long they lived. So that's terrific. It's newly FDA approved. We have this in the metastatic setting, and now we're looking at moving it into the early stage setting. And we have a couple of trials, a big Southwest Oncology Group trial and a French trial looking at moving this drug in addition to standard anti-estrogen therapy into the early breast cancer treatment setting. We've also seen that this class of drugs can overcome resistance to tamoxifen. There was a small trial called the TAMRAD trial looking at that. We're now looking to see, can it overcome resistance, tumor resistance to fulvestrant or Faslodex. And then we have a couple of other categories of pathways that sometimes can be turned on in estrogen receptor positive breast cancer that also might be involved in endocrine therapy resistance. And so some hot new areas, and there are many, would be drugs in a class called PI3 kinase. We don't have any drugs approved there yet, but we've got some good trials going on. Or even the HDAC inhibitors, where this is another pathway that might be involved in endocrine resistance. And it's going to be important to understand in each patient's tumor at the point of progression or resistance to endocrine therapy, which of these pathways are turned on or off, to know which drugs we should add. So in HER2-positive disease, we have some similar work going on. We know that many HER2-positive breast cancers respond to trastuzumab, which is Herceptin, or lapatinib, which is Tykerb, but some don't. They respond for a while and then progress, or they don't respond altogether. So we have some new strategies in what we call overcoming resistance to HER2-targeted therapy. We have a brand new approved drug in this category, a drug called pertuzumab or Perjeta. And this is a drug that is approved, again, in advanced breast cancer, For tumors that are HER2 positive and have had progression after receiving Herceptin. And these patients were tested in a big trial called the CLEOPATRA trial to add the pertuzumab to Herceptin at the point that the tumor was growing on the Herceptin. And this combination of these two antibodies to HER2 was far better than not adding the pertuzumab. And so what we saw updated at San Antonio was that within the CLEOPATRA trial that led to the approval of this new antibody to HER2, pertuzumab, in combination with Herceptin and chemotherapy. The trial looked at docetaxel or Taxotere as the chemo agent. We saw that Dr. Baselga, who led the CLEOPATRA trial, was trying to find what would predict even for benefit or resistance to this new drug, pertuzumab. And again, the PI3 kinase pathway that I told you might be implicated in resistance to estrogen receptor targeted therapy seems to be playing out as possibly being important to resistance to HER2 targeted therapy. We have another drug that will likely be approved in 2013 called T-DM1. This is actually Herceptin that has some chemotherapy attached to it, with the idea being that the chemotherapy will be delivered directly to any HER2-positive cell, which those would mainly be the tumor cells in a HER2-positive cancer, and the chemo would enter with the antibody, the cell, be cleaved off, and then only expose the tumor cell to the chemotherapy, not the rest of the body to any significant degree. So this is another method that we're using for HER2-positive patients to make chemotherapy delivery be more specific and to make a HER2-targeted therapy even more effective by attaching the chemo directly to it. We have a lot of research going on in the early stage breast cancer setting, also of combining different HER2 targeted agents. We have a big ongoing trial called the ALTO trial. It's actually close to accrual, but we're waiting for it to report. And this was a trial in early stage breast cancer comparing chemotherapy with Herceptin versus chemotherapy with lapatinib, which is Tykerb, versus chemotherapy plus both together versus chemo with first some Herceptin and then some Tykerb. So different combinations in sequence, looking at different HER2-targeted agents. And we have some preoperative therapy trials that show that this looks very exciting. The last category I'll mention is triple-negative breast cancer. How are we using the molecular portrait of triple-negative breast cancer to improve therapies? And Dr. Grana's already told you that we have some recent data that triple-negative breast cancer might be up to 6 different subsets. So this one subset of breast cancer, we might be able to divide into 6 different subsets. So all triple-negative breast cancer isn't the same, and we need to understand the molecular portrait of a triple-negative breast cancer to design trials and potentially to select treatments. So some of the subsets of the 6 different subsets of triple-negative breast cancer seem to be more responsive to chemotherapy and the platinum chemo agents in particular. It's been proposed that we call those subsets the basal-like 1 and 2 subsets of triple-negative breast cancer. There's an immunomodulatory subset that maybe immune approaches might work best in this group. The immune system might be involved in this subset of triple-negative breast cancer. We have subsets that we're calling mesenchymal subsets and mesenchymal-like subsets, and these, again, interestingly, if you look at the molecular portrait of this subset, they might be more responsive to mTOR inhibitors, like the Afinitor I mentioned with estrogen receptor positive disease, or PI3 kinase inhibitors that I mentioned also may play a role in ER positive and HER2 positive disease, or even a pathway called ABL-SRC. And then there's a sixth subset of triple-negative breast cancer that right now we're calling the luminal androgen receptor. And this one, we might have androgen receptor, the male sex hormone receptor, expressed, and we have some drugs to androgen receptor that we should be testing in this subset. So for the triple negative group as a whole, we have enthusiasm for these PARP inhibitors that Dr. Grana mentioned, and we had some preliminary success with small trials, but the bigger trials so far, the main one that's been done, haven't played out. So we're going back to the drawing board and figuring out all over again, how do we use these PARP inhibitors, which generally are being tested with chemotherapy to potentiate the effect of the chemotherapy agents that damage DNA. The PARP inhibitors come in and they block DNA repair after chemo's done some damage to the DNA of the tumor cells. So we don't have any exciting new PARP inhibitor trials, but we do have enthusiasm for using these agents in the triple negative subset, and more work will need to go on to decide if it's just a subset of triple negative breast cancer, maybe the BRCA1 and 2 expressing cancers that are going to benefit from these drugs. So again, I want to reinforce that a lot of what I've talked about is new and evolving, and some of these drugs haven't been approved yet, but a couple of them have been, and that's all based on our better understanding of the molecular portrait of breast cancer. This really is going to require a lot of communication between the whole healthcare team, the patients, the laboratory researchers, and the clinicians in order to bring this to the clinic and do the best for our breast cancer patients. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Grella. It's a wonderful presentation and just very informative. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Christy Case, and Christy is an oncology social worker. She's clinical coordinator for women's cancers at Cancer Care. And Christy is going to address really the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and also the role of breast cancer support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Ms. Case.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, everyone, for being on this workshop and providing such wonderful information. And as Carolyn said, I'm going to talk about the free support services that Cancer Care offers. So as we've been learning in today's workshop, there's a lot of information that we have about breast cancer, and it certainly can be challenging and difficult at times to understand what does this information really mean for each of you. So at Cancer Care, we have oncology social workers, and we're trained on how a diagnosis of cancer, here today that being breast cancer, can affect a person, family, their partner, their friends. And we are trained to help people with cancer as well as their families really tackle the problems that can come along. There's practical and financial demands, there's physical, there's social changes, and certainly an emotional impact of cancer. And adjusting to and coping with a diagnosis of breast cancer, it is an important part of your journey, and you certainly don't have to do this alone. So we can help in many ways. We have practical support and financial help. If needed, we can also refer you to other financial resources. We have emotional support services, which we provide in a variety of settings, such as telephone counseling, online and telephone support groups. We realize that cancer does affect the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by contacting us or by joining a support group or having counseling is really a sign of strength. Through our counseling services, it really can afford you the time to just talk about what your needs are, if you have questions, and what your concerns might be. And with counseling, really what happens is you can explore those topics. You can develop tools that you need in order to cope, you know, with your diagnosis. And for many people with cancer, talking to a social worker really relieves them from a lot of the stress that just holding it all inside and trying to shield loved ones from the diagnosis. It really gives that opportunity to not have to do that anymore. So as I said, we do offer a variety of support, and that includes support groups. So in addition to support groups for people with cancer, we also do offer support groups for family members, partners, caregivers, and any loved one. We find that many people experience a support group as a great way to connect with other people who are really going through a similar situation and are experiencing similar challenges. And some of the groups that might be an interest for all of you today may be our telephone or online support groups for people with breast cancer. individual counseling and support groups are both great ways to find a safe place where you can just talk about your concerns and your fears. A lot of times this really just lessens the isolation that many people experience when they're dealing with cancer. And when you feel emotionally well, it can certainly help you better deal with your diagnosis and the treatment that you're faced with. And all of our services are provided completely free of charge. We're always looking for people, you know, that are interested in our support services. So if you are interested in any of them and would like to join, you can just call Cancer Care and speak to one of the oncology social workers. Again, our phone number is 1-800-813-4673. Or you can visit our website, which is cancercare.org, and read some more information on it. So in addition to our Connect Education workshops, they do provide disease-specific information like today's workshop, but we also have workshops on coping with the physical and the emotional impact of cancer. We have fact sheets and booklets that are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to not only help people who are diagnosed with cancer, but also the people that care for them. And so these are just two additional tools that you could use as well. So again, all of the materials and all of the services are free of charge. So I hope part of what you take away from today is that you are not alone in this, and our services are here to help you. And I'm so grateful that you all are here today and that you listened and I had the opportunity to talk with each of you. So thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Christy. That was a wonderful presentation, very poignant description of all the services that everyone can access for free from cancer care. Now we do have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And Stephanie's going to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and then we'll take as many. And again, if we don't get to your question, you'll be able to call the 1-800-813-HOPE number, and I'll repeat that again at the end of the call as well. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Jacqueline W. Your line is open.
Thank you very much for a very informative teleconference. I'd like to ask any of the oncologists if they could comment on the studies that are being done on metformin, if they would, please. Thank you.
This is Julie Grelo. I can jump in here. There's been a little bit of work in metastatic disease. Certainly in the laboratory we have a hint that metformin, which is typically a diabetes drug, for those of you that don't know it, and it's involved in the regulation of insulin, that there's some hint in the laboratory that this drug may add benefit in breast cancer. There's some hints from some epidemiologic studies. So there's a huge study going on right now led by the National Cancer Institute of Canada called the MA32 trial. You can find that if you look at clinicaltrials.gov, which is the NCI's listing of all of the ongoing clinical trials. And that's a trial looking at early stage breast cancer patients and randomizing to receive metformin or not, with the goal being hopefully to decrease recurrence of breast cancer in the early stage setting. That trial is going on right now. It's actually still accruing patients, so we don't have any data from it, but it's very interesting, and the metformin data seems to be coming out in other cancer types too for potentially being a benefit. I don't know if Dr. Grano wants to add to that.
No, I think it's a great trial, actually. It's open in our area in some centers, and I think it's a phenomenal trial. Having said that, I don't think it's ready for prime time in terms of adding metformin to your regimen just because it sounds interesting.
Right.
Excellent. And our next question.
Our next question comes from Jenna J. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm in my third year of tamoxifen therapy. I was just wondering how recent is the research that 10 years may be even more beneficial than 5, because I'm unaware of that particular research, and that's open to any of the doctors.
This is Jenny. Two large trials have looked at this, both in Europe, ATLAS and ATOM. The first look at this data happened about 2 years ago, and there was a suggestion of benefit, but the formal presentation at this year's San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting really gave us a much more thorough look at that data, and there was a significant advantage in terms of decreasing risk of recurrence and actually improving survival. And the study was 10 years of tamoxifen versus the original five. There was a publication that came out the day the paper was presented at San Antonio, so it was published in The Lancet. And I think for the young woman who is premenopausal, this really presents a very nice option. For the woman who is premenopausal on tamoxifen and then goes into menopause, many people would consider, once we're fully confident that she's in menopause, transitioning her to an aromatase inhibitor, because there's also data that 5 years of tamoxifen plus 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor is superior to 5 years of tamoxifen. So I think the selection of who goes on to 10 years of tamoxifen versus five versus who goes on to 5 years of tamoxifen plus 5 years of an aromatase inhibitor depends on the menopausal status of the woman and I think other risk factors. There's some women that you may be a little more worried about the uterine cancer risk and you might choose not to keep her on tamoxifen.
So you asked about how long have we known about the data, and Dr. Grown is right. We've known about it for a few years, although it wasn't presented in any kind of formal final form. What we saw was there was about overall a 30% reduction in recurrences for the additional 5 years. But when you go into the details of the study and you look at the data, I think it's a little bit complicated right now to really understand the side effects of an additional 5 years. This trial only was able to collect side effects if they resulted in a hospitalization or a death. So it's really underestimating the side effects. Even with blood clots, you frequently don't get admitted to the hospital, so we don't have a very accurate assessment of blood clots. Uterine cancer, you usually do get admitted to the hospital at some point. There was 3.6% rate of uterine cancer for 10 years, about 1.6% rate of uterine cancer for 5 years, and 20% of the women in the study didn't even have a uterus. So actually, if you have a uterus, that needs to be multiplied higher. So we're going to see the results of a trial called the ATOM trial that Dr. Grana mentioned in the near future. We're going to be trying to delve into the risks and the benefits, the side effect profile of these drugs. And we need to really sort out which subset of women after 5 years of tamoxifen still have a high enough risk of recurrence to warrant continuing or even switching to an aromatase inhibitor. So for the higher risk patients, lymph nodes positive or other aggressive features, it seems reasonable to consider this with a careful discussion of risks and benefits at this time. But for the lower risk group of patients, I'm not quite sure how the side effects and the toxicities weigh out compared to a small benefit in a lower risk population.
Thank you. There's a question from Judy, one of our online participants. Are there any new developments in the targeting of BRCA1 and 2 estrogen receptor breast cancers? Dr. Grana, could you address that, please?
Well, there is a lot of work being done focusing on that population of women. We know that BRCA1 in particular has a higher tendency to have triple negative disease. 80% or so of these women have triple negative disease. These women tend to have abnormal DNA repair as the mechanism for disease. So there is work ongoing looking at PARP inhibitors, specific PARP inhibitors for that population. And here the PARP inhibitors may be working slightly differently than they did in the original triple negative studies that Dr. Grelo spoke about. There's work studying platinum compounds in this population that may also be very interesting. setting. So I think this is a group of patients that there is a lot of interest in, just because the mechanism of their disease may be different. But right now we are treating them as we would any other patient, and selecting drugs as we would any other patient who's estrogen receptor negative or HER2-new positive. A small percentage of these patients are HER2-new positive.
Thank you. And another question from Sandra on our online participants is it possible to reassess tumor tissue taken years ago to discover molecular features? Dr. Grelo, would you address that, please?
Well, it is possible. We usually keep the original cancer fixed in formalin and kind of in wax in the pathology lab. Some pathology labs, after a very long period of time, might remove them, but we usually keep them for decades. So you can go back to the original cancer, in particular if a cancer has recurred, and test for some of these new pathways. What I would say is, though, it's actually very important to know what the cancer looks like at the point at which you're making considerations about treating it. So if a patient has a cancer recurrence, it's more valuable to biopsy that recurrence and perform these molecular pathways and targets on the recurrence, because that might be different. And we've shown studies that maybe 10 to 15% of the time, the cancer that recurs has evolved a little bit, maybe due to pressure from the chemotherapy or other therapies that you've got, and a subclone grew out, a resistant subclone that is a bit different from the cancer as it started. So yes, we can access the primary tumor many years later, but it's also very important to periodically check the cancer if it's come back to see if it's changed some of its profile. We know that sometimes an estrogen receptor positive cancer becomes estrogen receptor negative, and the same for HER2. More rarely, they can become positive, which then opens up a whole bunch of new treatment options, too, if a tumor now expresses estrogen receptor and HER2 and they didn't before. So important to check the molecular profile not just once, but multiple times, especially in the advanced setting.
So then we have a question from Adrian in terms of the doctor-patient communication piece. What question should I ask my doctor to learn if I'm a candidate for molecular profiling? I'll leave that both either to Dr. Grana or Dr. Grelo.
Well, I think it is open communication. Ask questions. If you have a specific question about what may be pertinent and appropriate for you or not, this is the time. I do find that people ask, they hear about Oncotype or MammaPrint, and they ask, is it pertinent for me? Well, it's really pertinent only if we're making decisions about your treatment. Those two tests are appropriate to be done at the time of diagnosis as decision-making is occurring. So it doesn't help me to go back and do Oncotype 2 years later or 3 years later. So, again, I'm very open to having patients ask me, because I think it can be an educational process, but you need to be aware that there's a time and a place for this. On the other hand, when a woman has metastatic disease, that is also a time where you want to discuss all of the available technologies that are out there. Do you think there would be an advantage to doing profiling on my tumor? Is it appropriate for me to be part of a particular study that requires biopsy of tissue material? What type of studies are available for me? So I think clearly communication between the patient and their team is important, and you should never feel that a question is stupid or ridiculous. They're always good questions.
Excellent. Thank you. And our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Julia A. Your line is open.
Hello?
Hello. Hi, Julia. And your question? Hi.
Thank you. My question is, why is it that tamoxifen can cause bone loss in premenopausal women but could actually strengthen bones in postmenopausal women?
Excellent question. Dr. Grelo, do you want to address that?
Sure. Tamoxifen is in a class of drugs that we call selective estrogen receptor modulators. And on it binds to the estrogen receptor, and it can compete with estrogen. So it works when you're premenopausal because it can bind in certain tissues, including in a breast cancer, to the estrogen receptor and kind of replace the estrogen. Now, estrogen is actually very good for the bones. It has a great effect. When we lose estrogen with menopause, that's associated with bone loss. So estrogen is kind of tamoxifen is an anti-estrogen on the bones, in a sense. It's blocking estrogen, which is more potent for bone health. Now, interestingly, in the menopausal situation where you don't have much estrogen, so tamoxifen's not really blocking estrogen, it has a weak pro-estrogenic effect on the bone. So it has some benefit to the bone, but it's not as strong as estrogen. So depending on what your estrogen environment is, whether you're premenopausal or postmenopausal, it will have different effects on the bone. So that's a great question.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from our online participants from Doris is, where can I go to find out more information about molecular profile testing? So that kind of similar question. Dr. Grana, do you want to address that?
Oh, dear. I actually think there are many good websites. Breastcancer.org is a great website for information on various topics. At the San Antonio website, you actually will find information about many of the presentations that were given at this year's meeting. So that's also a very good, robust way to get information and recent information. ACS and NCI have great websites. I don't know to what extent they have specific information on profiling. You can read up about Oncotype. Genomic Health is the company. MammaPrint. Caris. So some of those companies have specific information about their product, but I think the better websites are sites that are focused on patient education.
And I also, yes.
I'm sorry, I was jumping in there. I also am a fan of the www.cancer.net website, which is ASCO's website. And if you're interested in some of the latest information that's come out of the San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting last week, I participated in a fun and very informative Facebook chat with Cure Magazine. So if you go to Cure Magazine's Facebook page, you'll see a summary of that chat where a lot of questions came in from participants on Facebook, and we answered them. And also, if you're into social media, which I'm not sure how many people on the call are, Twitter, there's a hashtag, which you won't understand what I'm saying unless you've done Twitter probably, but there's a hashtag of BCSM that stands for Breast Cancer Social Media, and every Monday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific time, they do an hour Twitter chat with specific topics. And last Monday and this coming Monday, they focused on the results of the San Antonio meeting, the latest news. And I know in January they're planning one of those Monday nights will be for a review of everything that happened in 2012. So that's just a kind of fun and different way to get the information.
And actually, this is wonderful. What we'll do is we send a follow-up to everybody on the call, and you'll all get a summary of this information that's been given out right now, so that you'll be able, don't feel like, I know you're all taking notes and stuff, but that you'll be getting within about a few days, you'll get this other information as well. But I want to ask our speakers all to comment on social media and websites and the concept of going to sites that you think are going to provide you with evidence-based information. Dr. Grebler, could you just comment on that? Because I know that's always an important concern in terms of people get information from different places. And so giving people credible sites is often something important for us to offer.
Right, and I think that's why Dr. Grana and I, the sites we've mentioned are generally trusted sites with good evidence-based, evidence to back the statements that are made. As anybody knows who's ever done a search of the internet, you can get really, awful quality information, some of it that's just outright wrong, and you can get great quality information, and it's a little tough to sort that out sometimes. So by sticking to the trusted resources, most of which clinicians have overseen all of the content or approved it anyway, and then only using those sites or sites that they also back, I think you can trust what you're seeing. But you should always, when you find something on the internet, even if it comes from these trusted sites, go back to your healthcare team and run it by them and ask for more information. Does it pertain to me? Does it pertain to my tumor type, et cetera?
I can't agree more. I think that's really knowing where you're getting your information is key, because at least if you're going to some of these places we've talked about, there is some medical supervision or medical input, and I think that's critical.
And Christy, do you want to comment on that in terms of the support groups and the women that you work with as well with breast cancer in terms of the accessing of information?
Sure. Well, there's a variety of ways that people can access support via the internet. There's different websites that offer different kinds of formats. So some are a bit more open in terms of open forums where anyone can visit the website and post something or reply to something. Others are a little bit more secure. So Cancer Care's website, you have to register, you have to go through an assessment process in order to be placed on our online group support system, and that is a private support group, meaning the world of the internet cannot see your information. So I'm always mindful to tell people, you know, if you are looking on the internet or you are, you know, wanting to interact with other people, it's perfectly fine to do that, just to be mindful of what information you're putting out there may or may not be private, and for the most part, you know, depending on the website, anyone can sometimes get access to it and write whatever they'd like. And so just to be mindful, just like they were saying about the other websites, you know, where is the information coming from? Is it credible? And I use this kind of analogy of, you know, looking at information, it can be helpful, but it also can be harmful. So just to be careful with if it's crossing that line and looking at internet information is becoming harmful, that's really not the point of it. It's really to help you, and as the doctors were saying, you know, have conversations with your doctors about what information you're finding or what information you're reading from your peers.
Now, we have a thank you very much. That's really very helpful. And there is a question from one of our online participants, actually. And the question is that breast cancer tumors have been described as heterogeneous. What profiling tumors, how is that taken into consideration for selecting the right treatment? Dr. Grana, do you want to address?
Well, I think you're not looking at one marker. When you're doing gene profile, you're looking at a variety of markers. So, for example, Oncotype is a 21 score, a 21 gene score. Some of the others actually use more. So you're looking at a whole variety of genes that are altered, upregulated, downregulated, and coming up with a picture of that particular cancer. So we are getting more refined in our ability to select treatments and to be predictive.
And there's another question which is similar. The person from Kathy, I'm a little confused about testing multiple times. Do you check the tumor removed or breast tissue or only with a recurrence? It almost sounds like tumors are left and not removed. Dr. Graylo, could you address it?
Right, so I might be the one that yes. was confusing about that. So this would be in the setting, the testing multiple times would be in the setting of a recurrence generally. In the early stage setting, would remove all of the tumor, so there would not be tumor left to continue to repeat. The testing multiple times would be if you have disease that is still on board somewhere in your body.
Excellent. I actually want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been extraordinary. I'm going to ask Dr. Grana and Dr. Graylo if you'd like to just in a summary form, just if there's something that you want to leave our audience with as a particular takeaway tip that they could just, we've talked about lots of different things, and if there's something that you each want to just leave people with as a kind of parting hurrah here.
I guess I would say that it's a very exciting time to be in breast cancer because so much is evolving. We are now seeing the accumulation of research that has been going on for 20 years really giving us some rich results. So I envision the next 5 years are going to be incredibly rich in our ability to target therapy, to identify who is appropriate for what compound, and thus minimize the toxicity that we're putting patients at risk for and increase the effectiveness.
Excellent. Dr. Graylow?
Well, I'd like to also reinforce that enthusiasm. I think this is an exciting time. Our better understanding of the different genes and proteins that lead to the development of each individual cancer are leading to better treatments. And I hope you take away from what we've been talking about today that we didn't spend much time talking about chemotherapy. You know, we're really looking at smarter, more directed therapy. And I do see that this is where the future is going. And as Dr. Grana said, we hopefully are going to have not only more effective treatments, but also less toxic treatments. So that's very exciting.
And Christy, from a psychosocial perspective in terms of the excitement, do you want to comment on that as well?
Sure. The takeaway message is, you know, this certainly is a lot of new, you know, and exciting information. And I think a lot of times it's important to, you know, just talk to an objective person about how this information can impact your own life. And a lot of times that means possibly talking to a professional social worker like us or being able to talk amongst your peers in a support group setting. And so I just want to reiterate that we are here to support you, to be a listening ear, to be an objective person, and to make sure that you have the right information and resources and support in order to continue on.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of you. And I also want to also thank our audience for really both on the telephone and online as well, giving us such wonderful questions really to enhance the call today. Now, this is an hour education workshop, and that although we are soon to conclude the program, it does not mean that the help that you can access from cancer care, that's continuous. And also, of course, your access to your healthcare team as well. But I do want to remind you all that you can contact cancer care if you didn't get to ask your question at 1-800-813-4673. We will be sending you more detailed information about the various websites. You have access to information and phone numbers as well that you can use if you want to ask externally just validated, excellent sites that we consider to be evidence-based information that's so important for you to have access to. But also, we do not want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with breast cancer. We want you to know that you're part of a community of support and that we're here to help you. We have a number of programs coming up in the future on breast cancer. We actually have a program that will be focusing specifically on all the findings of the post-San Antonio conference, and that actually will take place on February 6th, so stay tuned. You probably have information about that already. It's on our website. And also, this has been just an extraordinary program and a way to highlight really all of the new developments in with the treatment of breast cancer and the molecular portrait and understanding it. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.